content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is from the science section and is entitled Wood That Is See-Through Like Glass and Stronger Than Plastic by Jude Coleman. Thirty years ago, a botanist in Germany had a simple wish to see the inner workings of woody plants without dissecting them. By bleaching away the pigments in plant cells, Siegfried Finck managed to create transparent wood. And he published his technique in a niche wood technology journal. The 1992 paper remained the last word on see-through wood for more than a decade, until a researcher named Lars Berglund stumbled upon it. Berglund was inspired by Finck's discovery, but not for botanical reasons. The material scientist, who works at KTH Royal Institute of Technology in Sweden, specializes in polymer composites and was interested in creating a more robust alternative to transparent plastic. And he wasn't the only one interested in wood's virtues. Across the ocean, researchers at the University of Maryland were busy on a related goal, harnessing the strength of wood for non-traditional purposes. Now, after years of experiments, the research of these groups is starting to bear fruit. Transparent wood could soon find uses in super strong screens for smartphones, in soft glowing light fixtures, and even as structural features such as color-changing windows. I truly believe this material has a promising future, says Kui Ling Fu, a wood nanotechnologist at Nanjing Forestry University in China, who worked in Berglund's lab as a graduate student. Wood is partially made up of countless little vertical channels, like a tight bundle of straws bound together with glue. These tube-shaped cells transport water and nutrients throughout a tree. And when the tree is harvested and the moisture evaporates, pockets of air are left behind. To create see-through wood, scientists first need to modify or get rid of the glue, called lignin, that holds the cells' bundles together and provides trunks and branches with much of their earthy brown hues. After bleaching lignin's color away or otherwise removing it, a milky white skeleton of hollow cells remains. This skeleton is still opaque, because the cell walls bend light to a different degree than the air in the cell pockets does, a value called a refractive index. Filling the air pockets with a substance such as epoxy resin that bends light to a similar degree to the cell walls renders the wood transparent. The material the scientists worked with is thin, typically less than a millimeter to about a centimeter thick, but the cells create a sturdy honeycomb structure, and the tiny wood fibers are stronger than the best carbon fibers, says the materials scientist Liang Bing Hu, who leads a research group working on transparent wood at the University of Maryland at College Park. And with the resin added, transparent wood outperforms plastic and glass. In tests measuring how easily the materials fracture or break under pressure, transparent wood was about 3 times stronger than transparent plastics like plexiglass and about 10 times tougher than glass, according to Berglund. The results are amazing that a piece of wood can be as strong as glass, says Hugh, who highlighted the features of engineered wood in the 2023 Annual Review of Materials Research. The process also works with thicker wood, but the view through that substance is hazier because it scatters more light. In their original studies from 2016, Hugh and Berglund both found that roughly millimeter-thin sheets of the resin-filled wood skeletons let through 80 to 90% of light. As the thickness gets closer to a centimeter, light transmittance drops. Berglund's group reported that a 3.7-millimeter-thick wood, just over 2 pennies thick, transmitted only 40% of light. The slim profile and strength of the material mean it could provide an alternative to products made from thin, easily shattered cuts of plastic or glass, such as display screens. The French company Wood Ou for example, uses a similar lignin-removing process in its wood screens. The company is tailoring its recyclable, touch-sensitive digital displays for products, including car dashboards and screen walls showing advertisements. But most research is centered on transparent wood as an architectural feature, with windows a particularly promising use, says Pradyut Dhar, a biochemical engineer at the Indian Institute of Technology, Varanasi. Transparent wood is a better insulator than glass, so it could help buildings retain heat or keep it out. Hugh and colleagues have also used polyvinyl alcohol, or PVA, a polymer found in glue and food packaging, to infiltrate the wood skeletons, making transparent wood that conducts heat at about a rate about 5 times lower than that of glass, the team reported in 2019 in Advanced Functional Materials. And researchers are coming up with other tweaks to increase wood's ability to hold or release heat, which would be useful for energy-efficient buildings. Céline Montanari, a material scientist at RISE Research Institutes of Sweden, and colleagues experimented with phase-changing materials which flip from storing to releasing heat when they change from solid to liquid, or vice versa. By incorporating polyethylene glycol, for example, the scientists found that their wood could store heat when it was warm and release heat as it cooled, work they published in ACS Applied Materials and Interfaces in 2019. Transparent wood windows would therefore be stronger and aid in temperature control better than traditional glass, but the view through them would be hazy, more similar to frosted glass than a regular window. However, the haziness could be an advantage if users want diffuse light. Because thicker wood is stronger, it could be a partially load-bearing light source, Berglund says, potentially acting as a ceiling that provides soft ambient light to a room. Hugh and Berglund have continued to toy with ways to bestow new properties on transparent wood. About 5 years ago, Berglund and colleagues at KTH and Georgia Institute of Technology found that they could mimic smart windows, which can switch from transparent to tinted to block visibility or the sun's rays. The researchers sandwiched an electrochromic polymer, a substance that can change color with electricity, between layers of transparent wood coated with an electrode polymer to conduct electricity. This created a pane of wood that changes from clear to magenta when users run a small electrical current through it. More recently, the two groups have shifted their attention to improving the sustainability of transparent wood production. For example, the resin used to fill the wood scaffolding is typically a petroleum-derived plastic product, so it's better to avoid using it, Montanari says. As a replacement, she and colleagues invented a fully bio-based polymer derived from citrus peels. The team first combined acrylic acid and limonene, a chemical extracted from lemon and orange rinds that's found in essential oils. Then they impregnated delignified wood with it. Even with a fruity filling, the bio-based transparent wood maintained its mechanical and optical properties, capable of withstanding more pressure than regular wood and transmitting about 90% of light, the researchers reported in 2021 in Advanced Science. Hugh's lab, meanwhile, recently reported in Science Advances a greener lignin bleaching method that leans on hydrogen peroxide and UV radiation, further reducing the energy demands of production. The team brushed wood slices ranging from about 0.5 to 3.5 millimeters in thickness with hydrogen peroxide, then left them in front of UV lamps to mimic the sun's rays. The UV bleached away the pigment-containing parts of lignin, but left the structural parts intact, thus helping to retain more strength in the wood. These more environmentally friendly approaches help limit the amount of toxic chemicals and fossil-based polymers used in production. But for now, glass still has a lower end-of-life environmental impacts than transparent wood, according to an analysis by Dhar and colleagues in Science of the Total Environment. Embracing greener production schemes and scaling up manufacturing are two steps necessary to add transparent wood to mainstream markets, researchers say, but it will take time. However, they are confident it can be done and believe in its potential as a sustainable material. When you're trying to achieve sustainability, you don't only want to match the properties of fossil-based materials, Montanari says. As a scientist, I want to surpass this. Our second article is The Hybrid Car Dilemma by Patrick George. Michael Treeman is something of a professional electric vehicle evangelist. As the vice president of sales for Charge Smart EV, a company that sells electric charging stations mostly to business and municipal offices, his job is to convince people that EVs are the future and that it's time to start planning for them. But on his personal time, you won't find him in an electric car, or rather, a fully electric car. He owns a 2022 Chrysler Pacifica plug-in hybrid. For his family of five, he told me, none of the few three-row electric SUVs for sale right now can match what the hybrid minivan can do. With a Pacifica's small battery that powers the car for short trips and boosts its miles per gallon, we have gotten over 1,500 miles out of a single tank of gas, he said. The humble hybrid is having a moment. While this year is shaping up to be the biggest year for EV sales America has ever seen, it has also been marred by staggering production challenges and uneven demand from consumers. Americans are still wary of electric vehicles' higher prices, limited battery ranges, and inadequate local charging infrastructure. As a result, some car makers are dialing back their electric sales goals, battery plant plans, and even the tough love they once had for car dealers reluctant to go all in on EVs. Meanwhile, hybrid sales are growing at a rate that slightly outpaces EV growth, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. Hybrids now make up nearly 10% of new car sales, a proportion that's more than doubled since 2020. Unlike EVs, hybrids burn gasoline and create tailpipe emissions, but they generally create far less tailpipe pollution than their purely gas counterparts. The latest Toyota Sienna minivan, for example, comes only in hybrid form and has nearly half the CO2 emissions of its non-hybrid predecessor. Given the surge in popularity, you might think that every car maker would be eager to offer more hybrids to customers who are looking to lower their carbon footprint, but who feel unable to make the full leap to EVs. Nope. Enter what you might call the hybrid dilemma. Faced with enormous costs pivoting their businesses to make EVs, strong sales for gas cars, and shareholders who demand profitability, the auto industry can't decide whether hybrids are a bridge to an all-electric future or a dead end. At some point, Americans may still want hybrids while car makers have already moved beyond them. The problem car makers face is that hybrids involve all the complexities of internal combustion plus battery power put together. Building them takes a lot of time and a lot of money. Sam Fiorani, the vice president of the industry research firm Auto Forecast Solutions, told me, but a lot of their money is focused on electrifying vehicles. Diverting some of that money back into hybrid powertrains slows your transition to where you ultimately want to be. In 2021, General Motors alone announced a $35 billion investment into electric and autonomous vehicle development, including new plants to make EV batteries. That's more than three times the profit it made in 2022. When you're staring down such monumental costs and eventual death of internal combustion, why spend money to develop and build hybrids that still need gas engines when you can put all those resources into EVs instead? Car makers have varying levels of commitment to an all-electric future, yet there's somehow even less industry consensus about hybrid cars. Some hybrids work in much the same way as the original Toyota Prius from 20 years ago, combining a traditional gas engine with an electric motor. Others, like Treeman's Chrysler Pacifica, can plug in to charge just like an EV, further limiting their gas usage. Take Ford, which recently dialed back its EV production goals and is focusing more on hybrids. Ford is doubling the production of its hybrid model F-150, for example, which is proving to be more popular than its fully electric sibling. Then there's Stellantis, the parent company of the brands including Jeep and Ram, who builds America's best-selling plug-in hybrid car while also offering some EVs. The hybrid champion is still Toyota. It recently announced that the ubiquitous Camry sedan would soon be offered only as a hybrid, as the company moves basically to hybridize its entire lineup of cars. But GM CEO Mary Barra has said the plan is to skip a half step and bypass hybrids entirely to go straight to EVs. Volkswagen has similarly reticent on the hybrid front and is still debating whether to sell them again in America. After discontinuing one hybrid recently, Subaru is set to offer just a single other option, the upcoming Forester hybrid, but that won't be on sale until 2025. Mazda's sole hybrid option is a large SUV that starts at nearly $50,000, nearly double the price of the cheapest new Toyota Prius. Even Honda, another pioneer in the hybrid space, is down to two hybrid models, though a third is coming soon. Caught in the middle are the consumers who just want to save money on gas, but perhaps have fears about going fully electric, or can't stomach the cost of EVs. Rob Iannotti, an entrepreneur in Bellingham, Washington, told me he'd only want to lease rather than buy an EV right now, given how quickly everything from their range to what charging port they use is changing. You don't want to be caught with old technology, he said. Part of the challenge here is that Americans have a bad habit of making choices about a car that might last a decade plus based on costs at the pump that definitely won't last that long. The total number of hybrid models available actually dipped in the mid-2010s as gas prices went down, and only in recent years has started to rise again. For automakers, getting their car lineups to match up with rapidly changing consumer trends, gas prices, and their competition can be a nearly impossible task. Adding to the complexity is the fact that the stock market looks at legacy automakers as poor investments, Fiorani said. For now, more kinds of hybrids are coming soon to meet the new demand. That includes a broader lineup of hybrid Toyota SUVs, as well as more novel cars like the 2025 Ram Charger, a hybrid with a V6 engine that is more like a full EV than any other gas-burning truck available right now. Perhaps more automakers will hop on the hybrid bandwagon until most, if not all, gas-burning vehicles have some form of electric power. That would help cut emissions until EV charging networks are up to par. Or the rapidly falling cost of battery packs could soon make EVs comparable price-wise to, or even cheaper than gas cars. By that point, it wouldn't make much sense for automakers to continue investing in hybrids. Those are the most optimistic scenarios. The current status quo, a mix of different vehicles types for different needs, could persist and push us into a world in which hybrids don't do enough to mitigate our carbon problem. If car companies give up on hybrids before EVs become affordable and easier to charge, many consumers could simply opt for more gas vehicles, which isn't great for the climate. Or if automakers lean on hybrids for too long, they run the risk of delaying the EV transition entirely, which also isn't great for the climate. The electric transition may be inevitable, but it's going to be messier, weirder, and more protracted than many of us would like to admit. Our third article is from the family section. America Isn't Ready for the Two-Household Child by Stephanie H. Murray. For most of American history, when parents separated, their kids almost always ended up living with just one of them. But recent studies have confirmed a new era, joint physical custody in which a child resides with each parent a significant portion of the time, has become dramatically more common in the U.S. The trend is first documented in Wisconsin, where court data revealed that the percentage of divorces leading to equal joint custody, in which time with each parent is split 50-50, rose from just 2% in 1980 to 35% in 2010. Even among never-married Wisconsin couples who came to court to establish child support, a group in which prevalence of shared custody is perhaps surprisingly unsurprisingly, low. Shared arrangement doubled from 2003 to 2013. And a 2022 study found that nationally, the share of divorces resulting in joint custody jumped from 13% before 1985 to 34% in the early 2010s. Although the increase is steepest among high-income couples, it's happening across the socioeconomic spectrum, Daniel Mayer, a social work professor at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, who studies child custody, told me. The same change appears to be happening in Europe. The prevalence of equal joint custody roughly doubled from the mid-2000s, according to a study published earlier this year. The rate of shared custody varies massively among European countries, but it seems to be rising in many of them. On average, children in shared arrangements tend to fare slightly better than those in sole custody on a variety of metrics. But the couples that share custody are usually wealthier, better educated, and have a less fraught relationship with each other, which makes sense. Even in an unequal joint arrangement, a child must be housed, fed, and cared for in two places, which usually requires duplicating expenses. Coordination is needed to transport the kid back and forth. Whether the better outcome associated with joint custody reflect the arrangement itself or the conditions that make it possible is unclear, Meyer told me. And of course, in some situations, if one parent is unstable, for example, sole custody is in fact what's best for the child. Regardless of whether it's the right outcome for a given separation, though, joint custody is a growing reality, one that our systems for accounting for and supporting families aren't built to accommodate. Americans may be ready for two-household child, but American public policy isn't. In America's earliest years, custody of children, who were largely considered property, was typically granted exclusively to fathers following divorce. But as the nation industrialized and men began working outside the home, women developed a distinct role in domestic matters and a stronger claim to their children. Over the course of the 19th century, sole maternal custody became the near universal outcome of divorce. Both arrangements were rooted in the conviction that custody is indivisible. That bedrock assumption has made it difficult for researchers to track the rise of joint custody in the first place. The recent Wisconsin and national data provide the clearest picture yet that shared custody is rising in prominence. In one sense, this development is hardly surprising, as more couples take more egalitarian approach to family life, with mothers working and fathers involved in child care. More are carrying that dynamic into separation as well. Mia Hakovirta, a social work professor at the University of Turku in Finland, told me. This helps explain why famously egalitarian Sweden is the only country in Europe where the majority of parents who live separately share custody of their kids. Over time, and often with pressure from fathers' advocacy groups, legal systems in Europe and America have adapted to facilitate or even encourage shared custody. And at least in the U.S., courts tasked with ordering child support, Costanzo told me, have started taking custody arrangements into consideration. Our social policies, unfortunately, do not. Consider the Earned Income Tax Credit, a refundable tax credit available to low-income Americans. The refund is substantially larger for those claiming a dependent child, but a child can be claimed only once each year. That makes some sense in a sole custody arrangement. In joint custody arrangement, it creates confusion about which parent is entitled to claim the credit, and ultimately a lopsided scenario in which two adults regularly house and care for a child while only one gets state help. This problem has no obvious solution. Perhaps both parents should be able to claim a shared child for the purposes of the tax credit. New York, for example, already has what's called a non-custodial parent EITC available to parents paying child support. Something of the sort could be adapted at the federal level for parents sharing custody. But treating single parents sharing custody and those with sole custody in the same manner might be unfair. Splitting a child's care with a co-parent can afford more time for leisure and paid work than managing it all yourself. Another approach would be to base eligibility for the credit solely on a worker's income, without factoring in their dependents, and then award a child benefit for all kids, as many European countries do. Such an allowance would theoretically be easier to split across two households, though that's rarely an option in practice. In Germany, Anja Steinbach, a professor of sociology at the University of Duisburg-Essen, told me, the child benefit is sent to the house where the child is registered. As in most countries, there can only be one, and it usually isn't the mom's. And even in Germany, if Germany enabled parents to split the allowance, as dual residence parents in Norway can, that benefit would still go a lot further in one household than in two. Some Germans have argued that the child benefit should be more generous for dual residence families to account for the greater cost. Joint custody raises these sorts of complications for any program in which one's eligibility depends on the presence of a child in their home. That includes most benefits targeting people with low incomes, even those that, at face value, have nothing to do with kids. Take Medicaid, the public health insurance program for Americans with limited means. In most states, an adult's eligibility is determined by whether their income falls below 133% of the federal poverty level, a cutoff that varies by the size of the individual's household. The size of their household hinges on who they expect to claim as a dependent on their tax return. Again, each child can be claimed only once. Figuring out an equitable path forward for joint custody will force the U.S. to ponder some fundamental question about what it means to be a family, what constitutes parenting, what the government's role is in supporting it, and how much of it one has to do before being entitled to such assistance. The answers won't be straightforward, but two household children are already here. There's no sense in ignoring them any longer. Stephanie H. Murray is a contributing writer at The Atlantic. She's a former public policy researcher and lives in Bristol, UK. We have run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and have a great day.